the time allotment reminds me of a story of Mark Twain. I guess I'm dealing in Mark Twain stories these days. One time he told an audience, he said, "If you ask me to talk for 3 hours, I won't charge you anything. If you ask me to talk for 5 minutes, I'll charge you $5,000. And the reason is, of course, if he's going to talk for only 5 minutes, he has to prepare and he has to get everything just exactly allotted. So today we'll give you the free lecture, the 3 hour lecture. I'll start with a story about Daniel 8. I don't know for 100% that this story is true. The story comes from Cuba. And I asked some pastors in Puerto Rico when I was there, these pastors had been in Cuba, and I asked them if they had heard the story and if it was true or if they know for sure. And they had heard the same story, but they thought it was true, but they weren't 100% certain. Not too long after Fidel Castro took over the country of Cuba, he was making a tour of the military bases in Cuba. And he came to a base in southwestern Cuba, and the comandante of the base there said, "We have a young man here that we'd like you to see. He's giving us a lot of trouble." He said, "Well, what's the problem?" "Well, he won't carry a gun, and he won't work on Saturday. And he says he's a Seventh-day Adventist." So Fidel said, "Okay, let me see him. I'll find out if he's a real Seventh-day Adventist or not, a true Seventh-day Adventist." So when the soldier was brought in to be interviewed by Fidel Castro, supposedly the story goes, Fidel Castro said to him, "What does it say in Daniel 8:14 and tell me what it means?" So you see, Seventh-day Adventists are known by this verse, in some quarters at least. One of the persons I worked with was Siegfried Horn, and before he became a professor at the seminary, he was a missionary to Indonesia, a German missionary for the Adventist Church. And one of the jobs that the government gave him was to interview refugees from China. And some of these refugees would come claiming to be Seventh-day Adventists and claiming that they were trying to escape religious persecution. And so he was given the job of interviewing them and trying to determine who were true Seventh-day Adventists and who were not. And he told me that in the whole time that he did that job, that he didn't know of any mistakes that he made. He was always able to determine who were the true Adventists and who were just trying to sneak into the country. One more story from Cuba, since we're on the subject of Cuba. This one I heard personally from one of the pastors involved. You see, pastors in Cuba, not too long after Fidel's takeover, a fair number of them were put in prison camps for no other crime than preaching the gospel. And so every Sabbath morning in this particular prison camp, the Seventh-day Adventists would get together and hold their religious services. And one of them told me that he overheard two guards. And one guard says to the other guard, he says, "You see that group over there? They're Seventh-day Adventists. Don't have anything to do with them. If you beat them, they sing hymns. If you starve them, they get fat. And if you kill them, they rise again the third day." So this was one of the pastors who came to the seminary when Fidel sent the boat people out of the country, all the criminals and all the Christian pastors, not just Seventh-day Adventist pastors, but all denominations. He wanted to get rid of the leadership of the church. And so the Cuban church is somewhat behind the other nations in the Caribbean. We have currently, I think, about 30,000 members. We lost our beautiful college campus there, but we have since been given a new seminary on the outskirts of Havana. And that new seminary has been operating, I would say, about 4 or 5 years now. So the work continues to grow. But one thing they learned, you see, public transportation in Cuba is so bad that it's unreliable, and sometimes they could get to church on Sabbath morning and sometimes they couldn't. So what they did was they started having house churches. Well, there's a good model for that. That's the New Testament model, house churches. And you have to have a license for a house church. And the house church license says that you can only have 30 people in your house church. But one of the pastors told me, he said, well, we would pack in about 80 people into the house church. And the government official was always complaining about how we packed in more than 30 people into our churches, but they never did anything to us about it. So the house church model is successful and goes on. And one of the great teachings of the Bible that they teach in those house churches is Daniel 8. So that's our assignment and text for today. Now, just as one brief point of review, if you remember Daniel 9 from yesterday, we went through the 9 summary points. And the summary of the summary is there is a picture painted in Daniel 9 of Christ as sacrifice. All right, now we go to Daniel 8. And the first half of the chapter is very simple and straightforward. We have two symbolic beasts. And these two symbolic beasts are a ram first and then a goat. And the interpretation by the angel at the end of the chapter gives us the identification of these beasts. So let's start with the ram. So he looks in the vision. Verse 3, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had 2 horns standing in front of a canal. Now he has been taken in vision to the east. He's in Shushan or Susa, and he's at where there's a canal or a river by that city, and he's standing on the west bank. And he's looking at the east bank, and the ram is coming towards him. And the 2 horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and the longer one came up last. And I saw the ram butting west and north and south, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased, and he magnified himself. Now verse 20 tells us, the ram which you saw with the 2 horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. So we call this the Medo-Persian beast. And so the interpretation is very clear. And as we know the history, the Medes were the stronger power earlier. In fact, the Medes cooperated with the Babylonians to attack the city of Nineveh. They helped to conquer the city of Nineveh. And that was the downfall of the Assyrian Empire. And so the Medes were stronger first, but later, under Cyrus, the Persians come up. In fact, under Cyrus, they take over the Median portion of the kingdom. So the horn that came up later came up last, but it came up higher, and that represents the Persians. Medes were stronger first, then the Persians, and now we have this combined kingdom. There's 3 directions of conquest, and all of these were historically fulfilled. To the north, from Persia, takes you into what we call Turkey today, Asia Minor. And the kingdom there at that time that the Persians conquered was called the Kingdom of Lydia. And the capital was a city that's mentioned in the book of Revelation, Sardis. Sardis was the capital of the country of Lydia. And the kingdom there was known as being the Golden Kingdom. This is the place where Croesus ruled. And he was the king who, by legend, everything he touched turned to gold. And there's a reason why Sardis had that much gold. There was a mountain nearby, and the gold ore came out of that mountain and it flowed down the river, and they mined it and they panned it, and so that's where the kingdom of Lydia got all of its gold. And they were conquered by Cyrus in the year 546. And then to the west we have the story of the conquest of Babylon, right in the book of Daniel. And we looked at how the names of the medals change on the very night that the kingdom fell. And then finally to the south was Egypt. And the son of Cyrus, his name was Cambyses, he marched into Egypt in 525 and he lived there until the year of his death. And then he died on the way back to Persia. So all of this is accurately fulfilled and very clear and evident historically. An important part of this vision is, please notice that there is directional movement. Directional movement. He goes to the north and the west and the south. You see, when you come to Daniel 2, you just have an image and he's just standing there. He's fixed like a mannequin in a store window. When you come to Daniel 7, the beasts, they pop out of the water and they do certain things, but it's not yet directional. But this is very directional. basically the ram is charging west. And the final encounter to the west was Greece. And the Persians invaded Greece twice. And the first time was under Darius the Great, Darius the First, and that was the year 490. And from it, we have an event which will be celebrated in August of this year, the Marathon. The Battle of Marathon, and the news was taken from Marathon to Athens by a runner who happened to go 26 miles. And so that Marathon event is celebrated by the Marathon in the Olympic Games that will take place this summer. So Darius I was not successful. He was turned back. So his son Xerxes tried it again, and he did better. He conquered the city of Athens and burned it down, but he lost his fleet to the Greeks. So he had to retreat. So there were these two invasions of Greece in 490 and 480 by the Persians. Well, you know, the law of physics is for every action in one direction, there's an equal and opposite reaction in the other direction. And sure enough, that's what the goat does. See, the goat comes flying over the ground, and he's angry. The goat is angry. Why is the goat angry? Because of what the Persians did to Greece. So let's look at the Greek goat. While I was watching, behold, a male goat coming from the west. See, he's coming from Greece. He's going to the east now. And he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. See, there's stage one, magnified, now magnified exceedingly. So there's a progression here. But as soon as he was mighty, his large horn, he's like a unicorn, was broken. And in his place come up the four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Well, the goat comes flying over the ground, which represents, over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. He's flying, speed of conquest, speed of flight. And so, to compare, it only took Alexander 3 years to conquer the whole of the Near East. In that same 3 years, or a 3 year period of time, that's how long it took the Babylonians just to conquer the city of Jerusalem. Or that's how long it took the Assyrians to conquer the city of Samaria. In a 3 year period, those two events took place, those conquests took place. But Alexander, in 3 years, conquers the whole of the Near East, from Egypt to the Indus River in northwestern India. Speed of conquest, very, very clear. In the case of Alexander's conquest of his empire. And the goat is angry because of what the Persians had previously done to Greece. So it's payback time now. And so the Persian invasion has been responsible for the motive for the Greek invasion. Now there's an interesting story connected with the book of Daniel when Alexander invaded the Near East, and when he came to Jerusalem, he was going down the coast of Palestine on his way to Egypt, and he stopped in and he went up to Jerusalem. And the story goes in Josephus that the priests came out with the scroll of Daniel. Now this is the year 331 BC, and they opened the scroll to what we're looking at this very morning, Daniel chapter 8, and said, "There you are, you're the horn on the head of this goat." That's the story in Josephus, and Alexander was so pleased, as the story goes, that he said, "What can I do for you?" And they said, now, you see, critics of the book of Daniel don't believe this chapter was written yet, so they don't believe that story. But there's an element in the story which points to the fact that it probably is true because of their request. And their request was, they said, "Look, this year is our year for our sabbatical year when we don't harvest the fields. And therefore, it's difficult for us to pay tax. So what we would like to request of you, O Alexander, is that you release us from paying tax every seventh year when the sabbatical year comes around. And as the story goes in Josephus, he granted them that privilege. Now, the thing that lends support to that idea is that the year, we have tables that have been constructed from inscriptions and texts in Josephus and Roman Latin inscriptions and so forth. We can make up tables of sabbatical years. And we happen to know that the year that he visited Jerusalem was a sabbatical year. So that lends credence to the story that it actually was a true story, that the eighth chapter of the book of Daniel had already been written before Alexander ever came to Jerusalem. Well, he was successful in his campaigns, and he unfortunately died at a very young age. He died at the age of 33. He died in Babylon. He had marched east, and he came back to Babylon, and there are two different stories about his death. One is that he died in a drunken stupor. The other is that he died of malaria. So I don't know. You can take your pick there. But at any rate, he did not live to enjoy the fruits of his conquests. He had a son who did not come to the throne. And so his generals carve up his empire. And there was fighting between them for about 20 years. And finally, by 301 B.C., the four major sections of Alexander's empire had been divided off. There was Greece, Asia Minor, Syria, to which Babylon also belonged, and Egypt. And poor little Judea in between was like a ping pong ball between Syria and Egypt and bounced back and forth depending on who was stronger at the time. And so that's why Daniel 11 pays so much attention to the king of the north, which at that time was Syria, and the king of the south, which at that time was the Ptolemies in Egypt. And so Judea is kind of a victim to both, depending upon who was stronger. And so the other two kings in the north, the scripture does not pay that much more attention to. Now these four horns then continue for a period of time, and finally a fifth horn, a little horn, comes on the scene of action. And there has been much discussion about where that little horn comes from. The four horns go out to the winds, and then the fifth horn comes in on the scene of action. And so the question is, does it come from the winds or does it come from the horns? Well, to me it doesn't really make... I've written that it probably comes from the winds. I think that's probably true. But it really doesn't make that much difference, because you identify the little horn by all of its characteristics, not by one. And when you add up all of the characteristics, it's Rome. And so Rome is the little horn power that becomes bigger and bigger and more powerful, and one by one plucks off these pieces of Alexander's empire. Greece fell first between 160 and 140. Then in 130, Asia Minor was given to Rome. There was a ruler there who had no male heir, no heir to the throne. And so he willed his kingdom to Rome. And then the Roman general Pompey conquered Syria and Judea. And finally, Julius Caesar conquers Egypt. So the four pieces of the empire of Alexander have been plucked off by Rome. Now, the alternative interpretation, which is popular in some circles, is this little horn represents a Greek king by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. And he did some nasty things to the Jews. He persecuted the Jews for a period of 3 years. And the story of that is told in the books of Maccabees. Now, the truth of the matter is he was a relatively minor king. He reigned for only 10 years. And you can already see where the real power at the time was. Because he invaded Egypt in 169, and he conquered the eastern half of the delta. But he made a tactical error. He went home to Syria for the winter, and when he came back the next year to conquer the western half of the delta, where the capital of Egypt was located at Alexandria, Rome had sent an ambassador. Very interesting to see where the power is. They didn't send a division of troops. They didn't send an army. They just sent an ambassador. And the Roman ambassador goes out to meet him as he's on his way to Alexandria. And this is the famous story about drawing a line in the sand. And he draws a line in the sand in front of Antiochus Epiphanes. And he says, if you step over that line, all the might and power of Rome will come down upon you. So what does Antiochus Epiphanes do? He turns around, he goes back to Syria, and he never came back to Egypt again. So who has the power? Who has the authority? Rome has the power, not this little king from Syria. And so you see the progression. Persia magnified itself. Greece magnified itself exceedingly. And now when we get into the little horn, it magnifies itself all the way up to heaven. And so you have a progression of 1, 2, and 3. Strong, stronger, strongest. And you don't go strong, stronger, weakest to little Antiochus Epiphanes. So the little horn of Daniel 8 is not Antiochus Epiphanes, it's Rome. And we read of Rome's conquests here. That's the first phase. You see, there are two phases. And that's why it's important to understand directional movement. Directional movement. And so, verse 9. Out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, or a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, the east, and the beautiful land, or the glorious land. So the south would be Egypt, conquered by Julius Caesar. The east would be Greece and Asia Minor. And the beautiful land is Judea. And Rome conquered Judea about 60 BC and then installed Herod as a vassal king. So Herod was installed under the power and authority of Rome. And so when we read about Herod executing the babies in Bethlehem area, he's doing it as an attack stimulated by the dragon or the devil to eradicate the Son of God who had come into the world, but he did it with the authority of Rome. Now, so this is the phase of conquest, earthly power, imperial Rome of the Caesars. That's verse 9. But now in verse 10, I want you to notice the new direction of attack. It grew great up to the host of heaven, and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth. So you see, when there's territorial conquest on this earth, the action is horizontal on this geographical globe. But now there's a new phase. There's a religious phase, and the religious phase is directed to heaven. This is a veritable attack upon heaven by an earthly power. That's a religious attack. So we have come to phase two of Rome. We have come to its religious phase, the medieval phase. So what is this casting down of the stars? Well, in some places in the Bible, the stars is a symbol for angels. But here in the book of Daniel, there's an interpretation right at the end of this chapter. It's in verse 24, I believe, where it says this power, the little horn power, will be mighty, but not by his own power. He will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. So this is persecution. And we have right in Daniel 12 the story about the saints after the resurrection. Those who turn many to wisdom will shine like the stars forever. So the stars in this case are persecuted saints. And the symbol, remember, we're dealing with symbolic actions. The ram and the goat aren't literal rams and goats. They are symbols. And so this action of taking the stars and casting them down and trampling them is a symbolic action. And it's symbolic of persecution. So this little horn power in its religious phase was a persecuting power. Now, you probably know many stories about that, and we don't need to spend much time reciting them. I'll just mention one or two. I have taught a number of times in the country of Peru. Our school at Nanya, which is about an hour's drive south of Lima, maybe a little farther than that. In Lima itself, they once took me to a building. Very interesting place. It's known as the Museum of the Inquisition. Museum of the Inquisition. And it is the actual building in which the Inquisition was carried on. And it has three main rooms. And the first room you walk into, and it has the names of all the people who were burned at the stake written around the ceiling. And there's some interesting ones. Well, a lot of them we don't know, of course, but one said, Jose Levy, quemado para guardando el sábado. Jose Levy, burnt for keeping the Sabbath. You see, you can tell by his name, Jose Levy, he was Jewish. But he was forced to convert. And when he converted, he still kept some of his Jewish practices. And neighbors who spied on him informed on him. And so then you go into the inquisitor, the grand inquisitor's room, and it's a long hall, and there's a high desk. And here you see art in the service of persecution. The ceiling of that building has 10,000 pieces of carved wood. It's one of the most beautiful wooden carved ceilings in all of South America, in the service of the Inquisition. And off to the side, to the right, is where the witnesses testified. You see, in American court, you get to confront your accuser, and your accuser sees you face to face. Not so with the Inquisition. The accusers would hide off to the side. They would never know who was accusing them. And then the third room is the torture room. And I cannot describe to you all the grotesque instruments of hooks and cranks and what have you for torture. And one of them that impressed me the most was they had a little hole. And it went down about 12 feet. And they would put a person down in there for as much as a year. And they said people only came out of that one of two ways. They either came out insane or dead. So here is a persecuting power, and that's what's described here. But there's more. It's not just persecution of the saints in this world, but now there's a theological attack. There is a difference going on here. So he has some success with the casting down the stars. And with this success, he thinks, well, if I can just get the commander of the host, if I can just get the prince, I'll have the whole ball of wax. And so, verse 11, he magnified himself even to be equal with the commander of the host and remove from him the daily or the continual or the regular sacrifice, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Again, notice the direction of movement. Now remember, once again, let me remind you, we're dealing with symbolic action. The heavenly sanctuary is not on an elevator going up and down. To cast the sanctuary down is not to physically take the building out of heaven and cast it down to the earth. But in the eyes of mankind, as they look at where the plan of salvation is being ministered to them, they see the earthly appearance of cathedrals and earthly ministrations and earthly priests. They are not looking directly into the heavenly sanctuary, as the book of Hebrews urges us to do. So there is a difference, and part of the difference is about this unusual word, the daily. And so there's a long history of the discussion of the word daily in Seventh-day Adventist circles. And there's the old view of the daily, and there's the new view of the daily, and there's the newer view of the daily. And the story goes like this. William Miller and his fellow workers believed that the daily was paganism, which was taken out of the way to make room for the rise of the papacy. And that view was held in the Adventist Church until about 1900. About 1900, the new view of the daily came in. And the new view of the daily was sponsored by Willie White, W.W. Prescott, A.G. Daniels, and one or two others. And the new view of the daily was that in context, this daily belongs to the heavenly sanctuary, not the earthly, and it was the ministry of Christ which was being substituted or attempted to be controlled by this earthly power. And so we have these two views of the daily. And S.N. Haskell went to Ellen White and said, "What does the Lord say about the daily?" And she said, "The Lord has not given me any light on the daily. You need to stop arguing about it and get back to work evangelizing the cities." You know, sometimes the devil gets us diverted off into little non-essentials. And so earlier in her career, however, in about 1850, she had written once, "O.R.L. Crozier has the light on the daily." Well, what did she mean there? She wasn't dealing with this specific word, the daily, the tamid, the continual. She was dealing with O.R.L. Crozier was a man who wrote a lot on the heavenly sanctuary as the type, I'm sorry, the earthly sanctuary, reflecting in the heavenly sanctuary, the type and antitype. He and Hiram Edson and another man in upstate New York were really the first ones to make the breakthrough about our understanding of the heavenly sanctuary through the eyes of the earthly sanctuary. And he wrote all of that up, the whole thing. And it was published in something called the Daystar Extra. I think it was February of 1846. And so when Ellen White says O.R.L. Crozier has the light on the daily, she doesn't mean he has the right light on this particular word. She meant that in that Daystar special extra, his laying out of the whole sanctuary plan was correct. And indeed, that's basically where we stand today and what I did with the other class in the book of Exodus and the book of Leviticus. That this is the type and the heavenly is the antitype. And we've gone from one to the other in the Old Testament and now the New Testament ministration. So, we need to take this word daily in context. And to my understanding, since we are dealing with this conflict over the sanctuary, the daily should go with the sanctuary. Now we have some further suggestions that it is not so much the heavenly sanctuary's ministry, but the earthly sanctuary of the apostate power. So that would be the reverse of the idea. So, but at any rate, this word is a sanctuary word. It's used about, it's an adverb. And in all other cases in the Old Testament, it is used with verbs. And it says something is going on daily or continually. On and on and on and on, a round of ceremonies. For example, in the sanctuary, of the 80 times it's used in the Old Testament, 30 times are used in the sanctuary. The lamps were attended morning and evening, every day of the entire year for the Jewish calendar. And that was daily or continually. The incense was burnt. Every time he attended the lamps, he burnt the incense on the altar of incense. And that was daily or continual because this went on through this round of ceremonies every day, constantly. Even the bread on the table of showbread was described as daily because it was changed every Sabbath, 52 Sabbaths in a year. They continually kept changing the bread on the showbread, table of the showbread. And the morning and evening sacrifice in the courtyard was continual before the Lord because they did it every day, every morning, every evening, on and on and on and on. So, this word is used for those types of activities. Please notice that it is never, ever, not one time used in the most holy place. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say the cherubim are tamid or continually before the Lord. It doesn't say the tables of the Lord or the Ark of the Covenant or the mercy seat are continually before the Lord. It doesn't say that because the high priest only went in there one time a year. He didn't do it every day, constantly. He only went in there once a year. So we refer to these two parts of the services in the sanctuary as the daily and the yearly. And this word continual, tamid, or daily is used only with the holy place ministry, not with the most holy place ministry. So there's a distinction there. What is the antitype of the daily ministry? Well, we see it already in the book of Revelation. Jesus is walking among the lampstands of the churches. He's attending the churches, his constant ministration for the churches. He sends the angels, he sends the Holy Spirit. He intercedes for us, he prays for us. Revelation chapter 8, the incense are his merits that go up with the prayers to the Father. So this is the daily, constant ministration of redemption for all the saints of all the ages since the cross and since the resurrection. So that's the holy place ministry. The type of ministry that Jesus has exercised from the time of his ascension to the present. It is still continuing. And this earthly power, this apostate religious power, wants to imitate that and wants to substitute for it. And so you have a power which, if you ask a Roman Catholic theologian, Do you believe in righteousness by faith? Oh, yes, of course, we believe in righteousness. Well, how do we get that righteousness by faith? It is ministered through the priesthood. It's known as sacerdotal salvation. Sacerdotal, referring to priestly. So, the avenues of grace through the merits of Christ and what have you come through the priesthood to you. And the priesthood is therefore your earthly mediator. Now, this is contrary to Scripture, as you know so well. 1 Timothy 2:5, there is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. There's no earthly priest necessary. We don't need saints. We don't need Mary. We have direct access to God. And this has been the hallmark of the Protestant Reformation since the time of Martin Luther. Martin Luther proclaimed the priesthood of all believers. You have direct access to God without anybody in between you. You are your own priest in the New Testament era. You don't have to go to the earthly sanctuary. You don't have to have that priest offer a sacrifice for you. You don't have to have the priest carry the blood. That's already taken place. The antitype, Jesus, has carried his own sacrifice and presented it before the Father. So we have a contrast here. We have two religious systems. We have an earthly power which directs attention to itself as the source of salvation. And it has its own sacrifice known as the Mass. You can get confession and forgiveness right there. And if you don't follow the rules, you can get excommunicated. And worse than that, if you don't agree with this theology, at least in the times of the Reformation, you could end up being burned at the stake. And so we've mentioned some cases already. I'll mention just one other curious little case. You know, there were the reformers, and some of them died. For instance, Tyndale, the translator of the English Bible, was strangled before he was burned. John Wycliffe, they didn't get to him fast enough, and he died and was buried. 50 years later, they exhumed his body and burned it and took the ashes and put them on a stream that ran into the bigger river and then out to sea. So that's been taken as a symbol of the spread of the gospel, of the light of the gospel. And he's called the morning star of the Reformation. But I'll just tell you one that I think is, I found and saw myself, which I thought was rather curious. I taught for a week at our little Bible Institute in Florence, Italy. In the city of Florence, there was a man who tried to reform the Roman Church from inside out. His name was Savonarola. And the church didn't want to be reformed, and so Savonarola was burned at the stake, and about three or four of his fellow reforming priests. And you can go to the spot where he was burned, but you need a guide who knows exactly where it is, because in the plaza of Florence, there's a little tiny disc about this big, and that's all there is. And on that disc it says, on this spot, brother of Savonarola and three or four of his fellow priests were burned, and then it gives the date. I had to have an Adventist guide to find it. He took me there and he said, this is it. They don't want it to be known. So you see, the little horn was a persecuting power. And they don't deny that. There's just a quantitative difference. There's not a qualitative difference. Protestant historians say that many more millions were killed in the persecutions, and the Catholic historians say, well, it's much less than that. So there's an argument over numbers, but there's not an argument over whether the church persecuted in the Middle Ages. My own personal view is that we do not realize how bad the Crusades were. Here's an army launched by the Pope to supposedly reconquer the holy places of the Middle East. When they came to Jerusalem and made the final assault on Jerusalem in the year 1099, they slaughtered every man, woman, and child in the city. Only the Mukhtar, or the mayor of Jerusalem, escaped. The streets were said to run red with the blood of the people who were slaughtered in that conquest. And this was a shock in the Muslim world. They couldn't believe that the Christians had been so barbaric. Here's the Christian army launched by the Pope, slaughtering an innocent population. And so in the Middle East today, we never talk about an evangelistic crusade. Don't use that word, because that word is anathema. Still is today. You know, like the memory is still fresh. The memory is revived. All right, so we have a persecuting power. We have a power that wants to take the heavenly sanctuary in the eyes of men and bring its work down to earth. And we have a religious power that wants to exercise its own control over the elements of salvation. So this is what the problem is. What's the big deal in Daniel 8? The big deal in Daniel 8 is we have a struggle over the sanctuary. And with a struggle over the sanctuary, why is that so important? Because the sanctuary is the locus of the plan of salvation. The heavenly sanctuary is the headquarters of the plan of salvation. So you have these two poles. You have the true heavenly sanctuary, the true heavenly high priest, and the true heavenly ministry going on at one pole. And you have an earthly substitute for the heavenly sanctuary in the form of earthly cathedrals. And you have an earthly priesthood headed by an earthly high priest. And you have an earthly ministry being carried on in those cathedrals and what have you. These are two poles of the plan of salvation. That's why it's so important, because this is a struggle over the plan of salvation. Now, please keep in mind that we are not talking about the conscience of an individual Catholic. My grandfather was, the proverb is, the Irish are more Catholic than the Pope. And my grandfather was a Catholic to his dying day. As far as I know, he died a long time ago. I never met him or knew him. As far as I know, he was sincere, and God will judge according to the light that anybody has. And he was laying railroad ties across the prairies of South Dakota when he died from tuberculosis, and he never met a Seventh-day Adventist or heard about the Sabbath in his lifetime, I'm sure. So we're not dealing in this system with the conscience of individual persons. We are dealing with a theological system which we believe to be unbiblical. And so that's the contrast. So how do you settle that? How do you settle it? How do you decide? The word decide brings in the idea of a decision, and a decision is reached by a court, by the heavenly court. And so after centuries that this contrast and conflict has gone on, it says that the sanctuary is going to be cleansed, reconstituted, emerge victorious. And so then we run into a word that's difficult to translate. You see, the King James used cleanse, and the early Adventist pioneers used cleanse. The word is bigger and broader than that. And so I want to give you a little lesson in etymology. Here's the semantic range of this word. And the word that you have heard elsewhere in the Bible is tzedek. For instance, there's a king of Jerusalem named Adonai Zedek. That means, my Lord is righteous. Or the last king of Judah was a king named Zedekiah. And that means Yahweh is righteous. So the word Zedek means to be righteous, or to be right is the basic root meaning. To be right, and then you can be in the right place, you can be on the right trail, you can be in the right relationship, or you can be in the right state or character or nature. So here's Zedek. And this is the word to be right. This is the word used in Daniel 8:14. It says, the sanctuary shall be Zedek. So what does that mean? It's a very rich, as you can see, this is where we get the word righteousness from. And that's a theme which runs through the Bible. It's a very rich tapestry. Well, if something's wrong, you can write it. So, for instance, if it's unclean, you can purify it or make it clean. You can cleanse it. If you go to court and people are suing against you and you win the case, you are vindicated. So you can have a court case. And in this case, this word, to be right in court, means to be vindicated. But you can have something in the wrong place. Somebody took something away from you and took it off to another town. And you get it back. It's restored to you. So it's dislocated. And so it's put in the right place or restored. So you see, this is a root word which can have a number of meanings. And so when we come to Daniel 8:14, the question is, which one does it mean? Well, let me give you a simple answer. It means all of them. It means all of them. Why would the sanctuary need to be cleansed? Notice what the little horn does. The little horn introduces idols. The little horn has an unfit priesthood. And the little horn represents a foreign military invasion. All of these in the Old Testament are sources for contamination of the sanctuary. You can find this, of course, in the Second Commandment and in Jeremiah, unfit priests in Leviticus 21 and 22, foreign military invasions in Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Psalms. So this is what the little horn has done to the sanctuary. But there's more. Earthly courts have given decisions against the saints. But the heavenly court says, no, those decisions are wrong. And in Daniel 7:22 that we'll look at tomorrow, it says judgment was given for the saints. Notice the correct translation of that preposition. Judgment was given for, on behalf of the saints. Earthly tribunals may have judged against the saints, but the heavenly sanctuary, the heavenly court, judges in favor of them. The saints are vindicated. Now, in the symbolism of Daniel 8, it says the sanctuary is cast down. Well, that's not physical language. The sanctuary doesn't physically come down on an elevator and then go back up on an elevator. But in symbolic language, the sanctuary has been displaced in the eyes of human beings. In the functional eyes of human beings, it's been emphasized here in human eyesight. So it needs to be restored. It's given back to the rightful place, the rightful person, and the rightful state. So why doesn't, you know, there's a word for unclean, which is tameh in Hebrew, and there's a word for cleanse, which is taher. Why doesn't Daniel use this word in Daniel 8:14? Because he wants a bigger picture of what's happening. And the bigger picture comes with this root that has a very broad meaning and can be all-inclusive of what's involved in the great controversy and the cleansing of the sanctuary and the judgment that takes place in the sanctuary and what it will show to the human race. So this is what it means. And then when does it take place? At the end of the 2,300 evening mornings. What is an evening morning? Well, an evening morning, as you know so well from Genesis 1, there was evening, there was morning, day 1, day 2, day 3, it's a day. But it's a creation day. And you may recall that the basis of the judgment, the tables of stone in the great heavenly original of the Ark of the Covenant, are the basis for the judgment. And whether the blood of Jesus has been applied to your account and your breaking of those commandments. And at this time, A particular one of those commandments that has been especially obscured is the Sabbath. And Ellen White, in one of her early visions, sees a halo of light around the fourth commandment. It's at this time that there is an intent to a restoration of God's law, and that includes the fourth commandment, which has been especially perverted. And so just about 2 weeks ago, we had the Ten Commandment weekend for Christian churches in general. It was Sunday, Ten Commandment Sunday, for the churches who still want to put the Ten Commandments forward. And for Seventh-day Adventists, some Seventh-day Adventist churches celebrated the Ten Commandment Sabbath on that Sabbath. So, at a time when this commandment has been especially obscured, it's time now to shine the light on it, and to shine the light and to bring it forward, and to bring the... So as you bring the work of the heavenly sanctuary forward, you bring the work of the Ark of the Covenant forward, because you've now reached the antitypical Day of Atonement, and you also bring forward the truth about the plan of salvation and where it really operated from. And this happens at the end of the 2300 days. And as you know so well, as we already discussed, day for a year, 2300 days. There actually is a date right in Daniel 8 before you go to Daniel 9. Because if you notice the question in Daniel 8:13, a literal translation of the question says, one angel talking to the other angel, how long is the vision? And then it gives you some subsidiary facts about what's in that vision. The taking away of the daily, the abomination of desolation, the casting down of the sanctuary and the saints, and the trampling upon them. So it's the vision that contains these elements. What vision is that? It's the whole vision of Daniel 8. Where does that vision start? It starts with the Persian ram. So write the implicit answer to the question in Daniel 8:13. How long is the vision? Where does the vision start? Daniel 8 verses 1. You don't have two visions here. Now you have a Hazon vision and a Marae, an appearance of the angels at the end to explain the vision. But the word Hazon for vision occurs three times, Daniel 8, 1 and 2. The whole vision. And so the 2300 days covers it all. So what does that mean where it starts? It should start with the Persian ram. Now that doesn't pin it down to a year. It simply says that during the Persian period, represented by the Persian ram, is when the 2300 days are going to start. And that's between 539, when Babylon fell to the Persians, and 331, when Darius III was defeated by Alexander the Great. Sometime within that period, the 2300 day years is going to start. And you go to the next chapter, which says this 70 weeks has been cut off of what? Of what's gone before. And we gave you the connection through Daniel 8:26, Daniel 9:23, 8:26, 8:14. So the two time periods are connected here, and that gives you the starting period. And if you start with 457 BC, as you know so well, we end up in 1844. Now, William Miller, who was preaching this especially, never pinpointed the date that he believed Christ was going to come. He simply said he believed the 2300th year would fall between the spring of 1843 and the spring of 1844. You see, he was using the Persian Babylonian year of spring to spring. Well, the spring of 1844 came and went, and Christ didn't come. So there was what they called the tarrying time. Remember the parable of the 10 virgins? Some had oil and some didn't. They were waiting. The bridegroom didn't seem to be on time. They were waiting and waiting and waiting. And then when he finally did come, only half of them had enough oil. And that was called the tarrying time. And in the summer of 1844, the saints believed they were in the tarrying time. And in a camp meeting in Exeter, New Hampshire, several thousand people in attendance, Millerites, and the speaker was kind of droning on about prophecies that they already knew very well, And a man named Samuel Snow comes riding in. And they said, here, our brother has some new light. So Samuel Snow got up and preached that they should use the Jewish calendar, fall to fall. The fall of 1843, the fall of 1844, which takes you to the Day of Atonement. And so from that, the so-called seventh month movement went forward. And so that's why how they began to preach October 22, 1844. And when that great day came, an event did take place, but it wasn't visible here on earth. And so some of our critics say, well, you Adventists, you know, the prophecy failed, so you moved it from some place where we could see it to some place where you can't see it. Well, that would be true if the prophecy itself did not predict a heavenly event. And so, as we will look at tomorrow in Daniel 7, you actually see Daniel looks into the heavenly court and he sees the movement, the transit of the Son of Man to the Ancient of Days at the conclusion of the judgment. And to him is given power and dominion and glory that all nations and languages and tongues should serve him. That's the conclusion of the judgment in the heavenly court, not here on earth. We don't look for that to have occurred here. We look for it where the prophecy says it's going to happen. And so we have the date for this judgment that we've looked at here. And we have the event described in Daniel 7 that we will study tomorrow. Now, at this point, Seventh-day Adventists say, we can learn a lot about judgment and judgment in the sanctuary from the book of Leviticus. And our critics say, well, that's a big jump. You're going from a prophetic book to a book about laws. Is that fair? Well, let me point out a few things about the connections. Can we say that Daniel 8 has a connection to Leviticus? And I want you to notice, first of all, the symbolism that's used. The first symbol is a ram. And that's a clean animal that was used for sacrifice in the sanctuary system. In contrast to the animals of Daniel 7, the animals of Daniel 7 are the wild beasts of the field who were unclean. So first of all, the symbol of a ram. And we can say the same thing for a goat. Goat was a sacrificial animal, a clean animal, a sacrificial animal that was used in the sanctuary services. Then I want you to notice the head of the goat has four horns. And if you played a word association game with an ancient Israelite and you said, four horns, what do you think he would say back to you? Of course, altar. Then the word sanctuary itself is used three times. Then there's an interesting title for the angels. You see, in Daniel 8:13, it says one angel came and started talking to his fellow angel, but it doesn't use the word for angel. There's a common word, malak, is the common word all over the Old Testament for angels. That is not the word used here. The word used here is a holy one. And the holy one, or the holy angel, serves in the holy place. So the title for angel is selected according to sanctuary use. And there's two of them. Holy ones serve in the holy place. Now think for a moment about where you might have two angels in the sanctuary. Sure. The cherubim over the Ark of the Covenant. And then finally, there's the time element. An evening, morning. Well, we have said that this time unit is a creation day, and that is correct. But it is also a sanctuary day. And I want you to look at Numbers chapter 9. Numbers chapter 9. The book of Numbers gives the instructions about how the camp of ancient Israel was set up for movement. And they have all the organization of the tribes in order and the census of the tribes and the priests who are to take care and move the equipment from the sanctuary and the sanctuary itself. And so then they get ready to move, and God gives the instructions, as you know, about when to move. And how did he do it? Verse 15, chapter 9 of the book of Numbers, verse 15. Now on the day that the tabernacle was erected, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, notice the word for Ten Commandments there, and in the evening it was like the appearance of fire over the tabernacle until morning. So it was continuously, or tamid, daily, the cloud would cover it. So it describes the cloud over the sanctuary in terms of the evening morning, because the fire is more brilliant than the cloud. Evening morning, sanctuary day. Evening morning, creation day. And of course, it tells about how when the cloud is lifted up, the people are to move. And so verse 21, if sometimes the cloud remained from evening till morning, there it is again, when the cloud was lifted in the morning, they would move out, and so forth. So yes, an evening morning is a creation day, modeled on the time units of Genesis 1, but an evening morning is also a sanctuary day. So here we have six different features about the sanctuary. In fact, the essence of the whole chapter is a conflict over the sanctuary. That's the climax of the chapter. So if you want to find out something more about the sanctuary, where do you go? Where there's more sanctuary literature in the Bible? Where is that? Exodus and Leviticus. Exodus, the sanctuary is built. Leviticus, the functions of the sanctuary. So there's a very direct connection between Daniel 8 and Leviticus. So it's quite fair that we use that. So, in summary, the figure that we see, he's called the Prince of the Host. You see, the host is persecuted, and the little horn attempts to reach the prince, but it can't get to the prince. What is the function of the prince in this chapter? And the answer is, he functions as a priest. How do we know that? Because it says, the place of his sanctuary was cast down. His possessive personal pronoun referring to the prince. The sanctuary belongs to him. It's where he resides. It's where he ministers. And the tamid, if we understand it, is taken away from him, and the little horn power through its host or priesthood attempts to control it. It's his tamid, as I understand it at least. And so if that be true, and it does represent Christ's high priestly ministry for us in the heavenly sanctuary, he's functioning there as a priest, just as the Old Testament priest functioned in the courtyard and in the holy place at those three different locations. And this was the daily ministry. And so if you take all of the uses of that word, the word that would summarize it best, in my view, is ministry or ministration, to include all of that, not just one of them. You see, you may have a translation that supplies the word sacrifice. As Ellen White already pointed out, that word sacrifice is provided. It is not in any Hebrew manuscript. So it uses as an adverb elsewhere in the Old Testament what now becomes a noun. And so the question is, what is the extent that that noun takes in? To my understanding, it takes in all of the holy place ministry of the Lord Jesus in the heavenly sanctuary as our great high priest today. So the Messiah prince in chapter 9 functions there as a sacrifice. His death, what his death accomplishes. The prince in chapter 8 is the prince to whom the sanctuary belongs and to whom the ministry in the sanctuary belongs. And that means he is a priestly figure. So chapter 8, if you want to summarize the picture of Jesus, we're looking at pictures of Jesus at the climax of these lines of prophecy in the book of Daniel. Daniel 9, that's why we're going backwards. You'll catch the conclusion tomorrow. Daniel 9, Christ as sacrifice. Daniel 8, Christ as priest. Daniel 7, Christ as... We'll see tomorrow. All right, we started 5 minutes early, so we'll finish 5 minutes early. And let's stand for the benediction. Loving Heavenly Father, we thank You that today, as we look up to heaven, directly to our one mediator and intercessor, the Lord Jesus, we thank You for what He did for us on the cross, and we thank You for what He's doing for us today in heaven. We thank You for the riches of the views of the heavenly sanctuary that You have given us in Your Word. Help us to understand them better, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.